All right. So, PJ, we just begin casually now. Mm-hmm. We don't do a formal... Cool.
Yeah, just like this.
But y'all got to make sure you're talking to the mic when you're talking. Gotcha. Because y'all are pretty... Y'all look like you don't like each other right now.
I mean, we're pretty close already. I mean, goodness gracious.
Just gonna... We can get the big love seat up here and just have you guys both sit. That would be actually a really good idea. Be a little heavy.
The topic for tonight is intimacy.
To demonstrate it, Nathan and PJ are sitting very intimately together.
Dude, that's the way we should have done the masculinity podcast.
Should have sat next to each other.
Men just like aren't affectionate physically anymore. I'm just kidding. Dang, that was funny. Dang, you missed it.
This is Dylan.
This is Nick. And you're listening to
Colloquium. So, PJ, you like our
I don't know, remains to be seen. We'll see.
You like you like our what are you? You're responding to a question I haven't asked yet?
Yes, I am.
Do you like
we'll see
our,
if I was right. Go for it.
Intro song.
I do like it now. It took me a while to come around for it, because I think there was a while during which y'all just had the Colloquium song without the trap beat on it, and the trap beat took me a while, but I'm coming around to it. I really like it now.
You've discovered that we're what, Nick?
What'd you say? Like hip and cool hop. And whatever we are. Yeah.
Traditional, but also hip.
That's right. Nice tagline. Yeah. Maybe that's what we'll change our podcast.
The traditional hip Catholic podcast.
There it is.
Although, do you know you can't like put Catholic in the name of your podcast or like any like group that you start without permission from the bishop?
Really?
Yeah. So that's one of the reasons why, like, I intentionally have tried not to market Colloquium as a quote-unquote Catholic podcast officially.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Because if, like, a bunch of people are saying, oh, this is the Catholic, you know, insert whatever group it is, they're, like, representing the church. And so if anybody can do that, then, you know, it could go bad, badly.
Could go very badly.
So we're not a Catholic podcast, but we are a Catholic podcast.
Trying to get my mind around that emphasis there, but yeah.
Just think about it long enough and it makes sense. Yeah. Y'all just need to make sure you do. Like, you might even need to move the mic a little bit if it helps.
I'm trying really hard to lean
or
in.
Or just lean in. Just lean in.
That'll I'll lean in more. Yeah.
All right.
I think we're cool. Good. Okay.
No. You aren't. Okay. All right, so we just talk about things now.
I thought we were going already. That was pretty cool, I thought. You just went like, hey.
No,
like,
we are. Sorry, I made it awkward, yeah. All right, so we have with us, I don't know if our guests have picked up on this, except for the fact that his name is probably in the title. So, but we have with us our now most frequent guest on Colloquium, and that is my brother, PJ.
Hello, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Most frequent. How many times have you been on now, PJ?
Two. World record.
Wait, is that true? I feel like we've had someone else that was on twice. Am I wrong?
Oh, Emily was on twice.
I was about
twice.
To say, we had Emily on twice.
Okay,
yeah.
So tied.
Tied for the lead.
Emily's going to give me such a hard time for that. Shoot. But yes, now tied for the most frequent guest on Colloquium, PJ.
Good job, PJ.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But you're here, and I think we want to talk about, I mean, we could talk about 100 things with you, but we want to, I think, build off of our conversation from last time, in which we talked about digital minimalism, not using technology. Update, we are now more minimal with our digitalness. I was about to say that I, like, reverted from my iPhone, but I feel like, considering I have an iPhone right in front of me now, I don't know if... Yeah, I would believe that.
But you do have the Wise phone now.
I do have a Wise phone. I have a dumb phone that I use about 80% of the time.
Yeah, and I have to say, as by way of confession, that I have been noticing more frequently for some reason. I don't know why, but I've just been noticing how often people are on their phones, like out in public. I was in the airport this past weekend traveling, and
is that what you do in an airport?
Yeah, I was traveling. Okay. Yeah. And I was just noticing how incredibly often we're on our phones and just like how people are just sitting around one another and just literally no communication whatsoever with the people next to them. And I was also reflecting on what an airport would have been like 50 years ago if there were no smartphones, just what a like place of life and conversation it would have been. So anyway.
That's a really good point. Yep. Like you don't have to talk to the people next to you anymore. I feel like it used to be more common. You would just strike up a conversation.
Even on the plane, it's like an out now.
Yeah. You just put your headphones in. And they know.
Put them on.
This person is not to be messed with.
The same thing is very noticeable on university campuses. I like to play a game whenever I'm walking around campus or walking through a library, for instance, and just see if I can find anyone who's doesn't have a device in front of them while they're doing work. And it's very, very hard to find.
Yeah. I remember when I was in college, I started just going out and sitting on a bench. Somebody advised me to do that and not do anything. Like no headphones, no phone, like no book. And I would just sit there. It was so uncomfortable. Because you just like, you want to look busy, like you're doing something. Or you want to distract yourself. It was weird.
Yeah, it feels like time wasted at first.
It does.
It's like when you're sitting there without anything in your hand, anything that you're doing.
But then you kind of hit this point where it's like,
yep,
I don't have to be doing anything.
That's right. You get past the threshold. Yeah.
It's really beautiful. It's a really peaceful moment once you get past that initial anxiety.
Wow, we went there quick, didn't we?
Went where?
We went deeply, quickly.
We went deep, quick. That's deeply, quickly. They do say that.
Indeed.
Double adverb.
Thank you.
No, but I'm trying to think of how to segue because we're talking about kind of two things here. One of which is something, teaching, something of which we have all done some of, and we all actually devote a great deal of our life to, especially if you count coaching, which is very much teaching. And then I think we also want to talk to you, PJ, about attentiveness, which is something that came up in our conversation about digital minimalism a couple years ago. But I know you've done some more research on in the meantime, so we'd love to get your insights on that.
Absolutely, I'm excited for it. Okay. I think they're topics that are very connected too, because when I think of teaching, I often think of attentiveness as a really important part of how to teach well. So I think they'll tie together well.
All right, so I've got a few questions here about teaching that I've pondered that I would love you guys' thoughts on as teachers, okay? First question, can anyone teach? Can anyone be a teacher?
You go first.
I think so. I think it's maybe even unavoidable, just like having some share in both the active and the contemplative life is an unavoidable part of being human, even if you emphasize one side or the other. I think teaching and learning are both unavoidable sides of the same spectrum that we alternate back and forth between. So I think anyone, not only can anyone do it, but I think everyone has to teach in some regard insofar as they're going to relate to other human beings in their life.
I totally agree. I think it depends on what we mean in the question. Like, can anyone be a high school teacher? Maybe if they have the right training, but I think maybe what we're talking about here is just the general, can anyone teach something? In which case I would agree with PJ for sure. It seems like in the life of faith too, you know, and especially if we're to imitate Jesus as teacher, you know, that is something that is really required of us as evangelists is to teach. I mean, that's a lot of what evangelizing is to teach the faith and help others grow in knowledge of Christ and doing his will. So to me, it's an essential part of the life of faith and a life of a human being. Especially once we get into talking about, you know, everyone being called to fatherhood or motherhood in some sense, that is in and of itself a teaching role in a lot of ways. So,
yeah, I think those are good points. I think everybody is going to be called to teach and to lead others at some point. I think of like, and particularly back in high school, like, you know, you think about like leadership. Like I remember going to a leadership camp or like a summer leadership training or whatever. I remember thinking about like the question, can everyone be a leader? Because if everyone were a leader, then are there leaders if everybody's just leading, right? There's going to be some followers to follow the leaders. But I guess I think that what you guys are saying is important because, sure, not everybody – at some point, right, we're going to have to follow, right? Even if you're a leader, quote unquote, and you're a natural leader – there are some areas of your life where you will have to follow others. So I think it is true that everyone is going to need to be a leader. It's just like everyone's going to need to be a follower at some point. So the same thing is with teaching, right? There are times where you're going to need to be a learner and times where you're going to need to be a teacher. I think one thing I want to get at with this question, though, too, is that, you know, is the question was so the question of what you alluded to at first, Nick, is, does everyone have a disposition to teach well? You know, I think of like St. Paul in the New Testament. I forget which book in particular, where he talks about, I think Corinthians, you know, some are teachers, some are administrators, some are preachers, some are, et cetera, right? That we all have certain gifts. And so I think part of the question I get at here is teaching such that it's something that is a gift and you either have it or you don't, or is it something that with the proper learning anyone could do and be a good teacher? And I guess teaching in the broadest sense, but also in the more specific, you know, teaching in a classroom in high school or college, et cetera.
Yeah. Wow. There's a lot there. Maybe I'll use the analogy of me learning guitar. So I've been playing guitar a lot lately. And that's a skill that I, and a hobby and something that I'm enjoying that I'd like to learn and do well eventually, you know, over the course of several days of, you know, and hours and maybe years of practice. And I think I'm pretty capable at playing guitar. Like I have a decent amount of natural ability doing it. But am I as of a natural at doing it as Jimi Hendrix was, or, you know, that kind of a thing? Definitely not, you know? I think there is an element of, you know, teaching is a skill kind of analogous to playing guitar. But it's a charism that people are graced with by God to be able to do more than others in the body of Christ. So I would use the example of Dylan, you likely have the charism of teaching as a high school teacher and being able to articulate things well. Whereas someone who maybe has a desk job might not be, not have that charism, that grace from the Lord. So, but at the same time, I think it's important that that person learn the skills necessary to be able to teach when it's called for.
Because everybody's going to have to teach at some point in their life, and they needed to be able to do it well, to be effective teachers.
But it may not encompass a lot of who they are. They just might have to do it on occasion. So,
Well, unless they're, I mean, I'd say if they're a father, right, they're going to have to, or a mother, it might encompass a lot of who they are. But, I mean, it's maybe not, I don't know, there's probably a difference between teaching as a parent and teaching as, you know, teaching math in the classroom, let's say.
But you really are a teacher as a parent. Your job as a parent is to teach your children how to be saints. And so it's just teaching with a different subject matter in my mind.
Yeah. I guess I think one of the things I think of with this question is, you know, there's the stereotypical like graduate assistant professor, right? Who they come into the classroom and it's clear that they're smart as anything, but they can't teach. And they just, they're sometimes so smart that they can't teach. Right. They seem to just not have the ability to break down a concept and explain it in a way that the average person can understand. Now, could they work on it and learn? Maybe. But I think oftentimes for a lot of those cases, it seems to me as if there are people who just don't have the charism of teaching. And then there are people who it just comes naturally for. It's just part of the way they're made and the gifts that they're given. So I think there does seem to me, while everyone does have to teach and can learn to teach on certain occasion, I like how you use the word charism. I think there also needs to be a distinction made for the charism or the gift of teaching that is probably not given to everyone.
I think it depends a lot on what you're teaching as well, because I think there are some things that you can teach in which you don't need a particular charism for it, especially if there's a step-by-step process that you're teaching someone for how to do something, where you can kind of mechanistically go through it. But I think insofar as you're teaching something that requires a deeper sort of insight or virtues on the part of the learner or the student, then it really is going to be more of an art form where you have to be given that charism as a gift rather than just producing it.
Mm-hmm. Agree.
Yeah, I've always, somebody told me once, and I always thought that made sense, because I had a marketing degree first, marketing and economics, and somebody once said something along the lines of, yeah, teaching is a lot like marketing. You have to understand your audience, right, and how they think and how they make decisions. And I think teaching is the same way. Like, in order to effectively communicate an idea, to teach something, you have to understand the person you're teaching it to and how they're thinking about the problem or the concept.
Maybe that's a good segue into what makes a good teacher.
What does make a good teacher? PJ is like, this is the kind of thing I need to think for 6 hours about. I think, well, it's for starters, I think gifting, charism makes a good teacher. I think in my experience, it seems to be the case that they're, at least if you're going to be a teacher in a professional sense, I think there is, or in any significant part of your life, I think there is a certain predisposition that makes a good teacher. Something intangible. I think there are certainly skills beyond that, but I think that's probably the first thing I'd say.
Yeah, not to steal any thunder to our later part of the conversation, but I think definitely attentiveness to the students, like you mentioned already, Dylan, just an understanding of where it is the students are confused and where they already understand the concept well and things like that, I think are really important to good teaching, knowing where to move on and where to stay on a particular topic. Yeah. So definitely important.
Yeah. I think knowledge of the subject matter is certainly, not only knowledge of the subject matter, but also knowledge of, I don't know, I'm thinking with coaching recently, and knowing drills, for example, or in the classroom, knowing the right sets of problems that are going to help a student with a certain thing. I think sometimes those things can come with experience, right? You have a basic knowledge of the subject matter, but then with experience in teaching or coaching, you can learn, okay, what are the kinds of things that I can have the students do that get them from A to B, to understanding the concept or to putting that concept into practice. And I think some of those things just come from that base knowledge of the subject matter, but then also kind of a willingness to study, to see what works, to try things, to observe what leads to insight or knowledge in the students and what doesn't. Yeah.
How much of that do you think is universal regardless of what you're teaching versus how much of that is dependent upon the subject matter? Because that's one of the reasons I think I struggle with the question, is I think a lot of teaching does really depend on what it is that you're teaching or coaching.
How much of what in particular is dependent
on the art form of how to teach well?
Well, it's going to be different. I do think the skill set is going to be different depending on what it is. But I think, you know, one of the things I think teachers make good coaches as well, because one of the things I see as well is sometimes coaches who don't have teaching experience, maybe, you know, it's the same thing in, it's, you know, in the coaching world as well. Like sometimes the best players don't make the best coaches, right? Just like sometimes the best students don't make the best teachers. Where was I going with that? Well, I don't know where I was going with that.
Good question. I think, I mean,
you thought I was going to have a smooth recovery, and I did not.
I'll tell you what, you delivered that really well. Yeah. Firmly and with conviction. I have no idea where I was going. I think there are still deep principles that make good teaching, regardless of the subject matter. I think that can be talked about coherently.
That's where I was going with that.
That's right. Okay. I think so. For example, coaching soccer, which I do, versus teaching math, which you do, PJ. or teaching theology. I think the basic principle of, for example, being passionate about what you teach, I think applies across the board to teaching. It is desirable to have that to be a good teacher, period, to be passionate about what you're teaching, or at the very least to understand why it is that you're teaching what you're teaching. I think those two things are important no matter what.
Now, though, to speak to something that might vary, right, just thinking about coaching, right, for certain sports, I'm sure most sports, I think in baseball, sometimes being very detail-oriented, being able to break down the mechanics of somebody's swing or their throwing motion or fielding motion is huge, right, to be able to identify those little things, whereas teaching a math problem, sure, you have to notice like little mistakes that people make, but I don't know that you have to be the same kind of observant that maybe there's an observant, right, to pick up on somebody's mistake, but it's not this, it doesn't seem to me to be the same skill set as being able to notice when somebody's hands are slightly in the wrong place when they're going through their motion.
I think it's definitely different, but I don't think it's a matter of more detail in the coaching baseball than in teaching math, because I think you can notice a lot of the very intricate details about how a student is responding even to your follow-up questions about a particular problem that they're working on, and how long they pause between venturing a guess and then asking another question. Things like that, where if you pay enough attention, you really can find things to fine-tune about
That's
how they're approaching the problem.
Yeah. So like in the question that they're asking, being able to identify in the way they're asking it what exactly it is that they're stuck on.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, but that to me seems like a different detail-orientedness than noticing somebody's thumb position being off.
Sure. Yeah, it's definitely
it's more of a it's almost more of a psychological or like a human relational type skill than it is, or communication skill than it is a observational skill, I think.
Fair.
But I think you're right. There is both a detail orientedness in both of those, certainly.
Can I add another principle or two that I think work regardless of?
I don't know, Nick. What do you think?
The setting, which
I think we've decided to allow it.
Okay, great. Judges have ruled.
So I think another helpful one is knowing how to meet your students slightly above where they are.
Yes.
So meeting them where they are in an incarnational way, but also drawing them higher.
Knowing what the next step is. Yeah. Right, and not thinking the next step is actually six steps ahead of.
Yeah, you have to know where they are to know what the next step is.
Yeah.
Which can be a really tricky art form because you have to follow them as they're making progress and always stay one step ahead of them so that they can really stay in the right stage to keep learning.
That's really good.
Teaching is such a – I've really come around to this in my experience teaching a little bit and also coaching, that teaching is really a skill that needs to be developed, you know, because there's just a lot of nuances to it. One of the things that came up to my mind when you were talking was, like, we can talk about collectively, in fact, we should a lot of times talk collectively about the students, but in reality, you probably got, I don't know how many kids you have in your math class, but probably 30, let's say, that are all, that they might be all in different places, you know, at one point in time, you know, so it's also a matter of judging, okay, this group of students in my class is here. This other group of students is farther back. How can I challenge both and keep them engaged while also, you know, progressing them along, so on and so forth. So it's not even, you know, as simple as understanding where, quote, the students are. It's also being able to give individual attention as best as possible to each student.
Do you think the traditional classroom environment really impedes getting to know where each student is at in particular and meeting them where they're at?
In some ways, especially if it's a large class, I think that can impede it. But I do think there's a lot that's possible within a traditional classroom format, depending on how you run it.
Yeah. Are you a fan of the traditional classroom environment? Having
15 I think it depends on the subject. I think it's
students
a big topic.
Okay.
Yeah. I do think it would be good if we mixed in students more with people of different ages so that there were people slightly above them, slightly below them, that they were constantly interacting with. Yeah. Because a big part of learning is teaching. In order to learn well, it's often helpful to teach well.
You know, they say, like, you learn 10 times quicker when you teach or something. It's, I don't know if that's the right number, but you learn quicker when you teach it.
Yeah. But I like what you're saying, Nick, about how absolutely vital it is to be attentive to your students as a teacher. I think that's another key principle, like attentiveness to your students as individuals rather than just as an anonymous mob of people. And I think also attentiveness to them, if we're truly paying attention to our students, we will treat them less as machines who need to go through the motions of the proper steps of how to swing a baseball bat correctly or how to do a math problem correctly, and really see them as the human beings they are, so that we can cultivate virtue in them rather than just the right steps going through a process.
So why don't we go ahead and go there, since you keep throwing this word attentiveness out. What exactly do you mean by that, attentiveness?
Yeah, so attentiveness is a really tricky thing to define. I think the last time I was on this podcast, we talked a little bit about attentiveness. And at the time, I was very inclined to speak of it as this very passive affair. Like, you kind of just have to sit in the corner and be very open to what's being said to you. But I think over the past few years, I've come to realize how attentiveness is really both active and passive. And it's not about just being entirely passive or being entirely active. It's not about focusing as much as you can to the exclusion of mind wandering. It's really about the virtuous back and forth between narrowing your attention by focusing on something and allowing your mind to wander to new ideas, and being active with your attention while also being passive with it. So I think attentiveness is a virtue of how to pay attention well.
If you had to put it like on a soundbite, like, you know, a 15-year-old walks up to you, what is attentiveness, Dr. Jedlevec?
Attentiveness is the ability to pay attention well.
Okay. No, that's good. Yeah. That's good. You define the word with the word, but this, but yeah, the ability to pay attention well. Okay.
I really like that.
And why is this such an important concept?
I think it's important for teaching in particular and for life in general, because I think it's important for life in general because attention is very, very deeply tied with love. In order to love something well, you have to be able to know it, and in order to know it, you have to be able to pay attention to it in the right way. Mm-hmm. But I think it's particularly relevant for teaching because, especially when it comes to more teaching of more intellectual topics as opposed to things like baseball, teaching is really not about the communication of different data points to people. It's really the communication of something deeper, something like insight, something like understanding or vision of how things fit together as a whole. And
which is why, like, so just to jump in there, you know, when I think about teaching, one of the things I've always noticed is that facts, data points, are very, very quickly forgotten. You know, students can memorize facts or data points for a test, forget it the very next day. And the reason why I've always thought that is they've connected it to nothing meaningful. And when you use the insight, I think of that connection between information and meaning, right? So when I have an insight, I have now made a meaningful connection with the data that has been given to me. And once something about the educational process and who we are as human beings, right, we remember things that we've associated meaning with. And that's why I think so often people, you know, have this moment sometimes long after high school. PJ and I were talking about this today. It's like, oh, well, why didn't they teach me that in high school? It's like, well, the message was probably conveyed on a lot of these things. You know, I hear this a lot. Oh, I didn't learn that at Catholic school. Well, you didn't learn it, right? But it was probably said to you at some point, but you weren't in a place where it was communicated as necessarily insight, or you received it as insight and made a meaningful connection with it. I don't know. Am I on the right track with insight?
Absolutely.
There?
And I think that's the tricky thing about teaching well, is it's not just communicating information to people, because if you're just communicating information, it'll get lost pretty quickly and it won't stay with them, but it's figuring out how to arrange the data and information in exactly the right way so that it will click with the students and they will see how it's meaningful and important to them and see how it all fits together. And as a result, I think our job as teachers is less about channeling a bunch of information into them as if they're machines, but it's really the art of teaching them how to pay attention well so that they can have those insights.
That's true, isn't it? Yeah, I know as a math student, I did teach for a little bit, but just turning it on, you know, the experience of being a student, I know what a good feeling that is and how it sinks in just more deeply when, you know, the concept being drawn on the whiteboard by the teacher or, you know, whatever it is, like the latest theorem in geometry class, all of a sudden just makes sense. And I don't need to worry about memorizing how to do this exact problem anymore. You know, I understand why the theorem works and how it works. And pretty much any problem, more or less, is going to be doable because I understand the root principle of the thing. So I understand, like how as a student, I desire that. I'm grasping for that, you know, that insight, if you will, rather than the data point. So the goal of a teacher is really to give it to the student who desires that. Interesting.
Where do you think insight comes from?
Okay, I was kind of thinking a similar thing because I was going to ask you, like, is attentiveness, does attentiveness lead to insight necessarily? Is this kind of part of the point you're trying to make?
I don't think it necessarily leads to insight. I think one of the key points is that insight isn't something that can be produced by any mechanism or process. It's fundamentally a gift that comes to us in a eureka moment or as a gift, like, from above.
Well, it's like, it makes me think of like church's teaching on prayer and contemplative prayer.
Exactly.
In particular. Yeah. Like you've got vocal prayer, you've got mental prayer, which is like meditating on scripture, reflecting on scripture. But then contemplation is defined really strangely sometimes if you just look at what the catechism says. Because it's basically like you just said, it's a gift, it's something we can't produce, but it kind of comes from meditation. Like if you do meditation, it leads to contemplation. Mm. But you can't produce contemplation via XYZ steps of meditation. So it seems kind of similar to that.
I'm also reminded of a book I know both of us really like by Father Jacques Philippe called Time for God, in which one of the arguments he lays out is that mental prayer and a deep prayer life isn't something you can produce, that all you can really do is cultivate an attitude of openness so you can receive the gift of prayer from God. And I think the same thing is true of insight.
Mm-hmm. Oh man, that connects really well. I keep coming back to me as a learner, you know, just how, like, whenever I understood a concept, it was, you know, these like aha moments or whatever in learning of like, oh, now I understand. And it really was a gift in a sense, you know, and it also took my being attentive and really just honing in my focus on what was being communicated by the teacher or, you know, in prayer, what the Lord was, you know, trying to say to me, you know. So it's both and, you know, the teaching requires the ability to understand the insight and how to communicate it, but the learner also requires attentiveness to an openness to grasping whatever insight is being relayed.
Mm-hmm. So insight is like this aha moment, right? It's like that eureka moment of grasping something with meaning. Would you say that insight is inherently, there's meaning there as well?
I think so. Yeah.
Attentiveness then is the attitude that kind of opens us to receiving insight because we're paying attention and open. And then there's the teacher, right? And the teacher's job is to somehow make this communication of info lead to insight. So you have to do probably two things. One is cultivate attentiveness, and then two is conjure up insight. Like what is that other aspect of?
Maybe an analogy would be helpful, because if insight is the intellectual version of the gift, more generally speaking, and attentiveness is how you are receptive to that particular type of gift, we could ask the question of how do you teach someone how to receive gifts well? So imagine you're a parent and you really want your kids to be really good at receiving gifts in the right way. What do you do? Well, you have to start by giving them some gifts and seeing how they react, and then paying attention to how they react to that. And if they don't say thank you, saying, hey, you should really say thank you for that gift. Or if they're overeager and they say, oh, give me the gift, you have to say, no, let's pause, let's slow down a little bit. In order to receive a gift well, you have to wait to receive it. So I wonder if that image can be helpful in thinking about what attentiveness requires. It's really the art of teaching someone how to receive a gift well in an intellectual field.
That's fascinating. I love this. One of the things that I've learned in coaching recently is this idea of limiting the amount of, so I'm a soccer coach, so a drill is very continuous a lot of times in soccer. We're playing a game, I pause the drill to say something. It was, you know, learned by me recently that you really don't want to say communicate instruction or ask a question or have conversation in the middle of the drill for more than like 1 minute or so, because what happens is you're going to lose the focus and attention of the players.
Yeah.
So I know there's this thing of, you know, quote unquote, attention span. Mm-hmm. We hear that a lot of, you know, especially with kids, their attention span is short. But I think just having an understanding of the attentiveness span, I guess, if you will, of the people that you're teaching might be an important place to start in teaching a concept, is understanding, okay, like I can't, you know, pause and teach this for very long at this point in time because their attentiveness span is shorter.
Go ahead. Yeah. Well, and I think one thing of like, I think a good teacher is aware of that, right? So you go back to qualities of a good teacher and aware of the attention span, aware of that moment where they're no longer paying attention. I can kind of feel this sometimes, probably more so in the classroom than on the field. Cause it's just, I think you're pushing the limits of their attention sometimes a little bit more in the classroom. But I love the moments, like there are moments in the classroom where I can just feel like the whole room is locked on me and what I'm saying. I communicate something that communicates insight and they have audible kind of aha moments. Like those are the moments you live for as a teacher. And then I can feel the moments where it's like I'm teaching something and they may not be being disrespectful, but I can tell half the room has just lost attention. It is not necessarily my fault. Maybe it's an hour into class and it's been a long day, right? But I can tell that I've lost them at that point. And sometimes I'll just quit there because I know that whatever I communicate at that point, if the attentiveness isn't there and it's not coming back, then it's just going to be lost on deaf ears.
And I think what you do in that moment is really important, because I think there's a strong temptation when you know that your students aren't paying attention to you to try to capture their attention again and do something really flashy to get it back, right?
I usually just like do a dance or like yell and scream and say, hey, pay attention to me. Hey, hey, hey.
Well, you joke, but honestly, I think that's the strategy that a lot of attention capturing devices use as well in order to capture people's attention. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of the mode that we're brought up.
Yeah.
But I think if you understand how a properly functioning attention works and that mind wandering is an important part of paying attention well, then that desire to control your student's attention and grasp it goes away a little bit.
So an example of this in technology that I encountered the other day, I was on YouTube and I was scrolling through videos, suggested videos, and something popped up. It said, do you want to see something different? Click here to see something outside of what you normally watch. And that was like exactly that. It's like, oh, we're losing your attention. Come back, come back. I was like, whoa, this is weird. So I put my phone down at that point.
But. Gosh. So let me ask, PJ, what would you do in that moment when the students are losing attention? You can see it clearly. What's a technique that you have tried or you would suggest trying? If you have thoughts on that,
I think taking a break is a great idea. Like sometimes if something isn't landing and students are voting with their eyes and their minds that this is not relevant to us, then take a break. And one thing I found really helpful is to actually tell them what to do during that break. Mm-hmm. When I give students a break during class and I say, do whatever you want, without fail, they all pull out their phones, which is an activity that, even if it's enjoyable in the moment for them, is not attentionally restorative. It's not actually giving them the capacity to be refreshed in their attention. So I like to take a 5-10 minute break in the middle of an especially long class and say, you're gonna go for a walk with a different person in your class, to maybe ask them a few questions and allow your mind to wander. And I find when I do something like that, when we come back into class, they're really engaged and actually ready to listen to whatever we're saying.
Yeah, it's another example of that. I had a professor in college who would if you were falling asleep in class, she would tell you to go get a drink of water. She's like, she would literally, and then you'd come back and you're a little bit more awake. You could pay attention, but it's similar. Like, and I've done that a few times in class as well. And I found that it's, yeah, that kind of structured, guided break, because sometimes we're just so weak and of the flesh that we're just going to turn to the most mind numbing time passing thing we can. And, but that doesn't recharge, right? It doesn't necessarily cultivate that virtue of attentiveness or bring back the attentiveness.
Yeah. I think an important component of both of those is the fact that they get students moving too. We forget that we are bodily creatures, and that a big part of paying attention well is using our bodies in that. So,
One of this is just an aside, but one of the things that has, it's a simple thing, but one of the things that a priest has told me, you know, through a talk he gave about praying the rosary is, I don't know about you guys, but I get really distracted praying the rosary sitting down or kneeling. I just cannot focus on a decade even of the rosary while doing that. So he just said, hey, for some reason, especially men, just like concentrate better when they walk, when they move. So like praying a walking rosary has been really meaningful for me and concentrating on the decades, on the mysteries. So that I think is a perfect example of motion creating attentiveness.
I think that's a great example, because the attitude needed to pray well is very similar to the attitude needed to receive an insight and listen well in a class.
So is attentiveness something that we need to have all the time?
Yes, I think so.
I think, yeah, just to nuance your definition a little bit, because I think, what was it again? To the virtue of paying attention well, is that right? I think the phrase paying attention sends the message that we're focusing on something.
I
don't think that's what you mean. I think what you mean is, I'll stab at it, you can tell me whether I'm right or wrong, being able to give as much attention as is needed at the time. Maybe that's what you're getting at.
I think that's accurate. And I think it's a tricky thing to define, precisely because, like love itself, it transcends the categories we ordinarily use to define things. Yep. So I like to define it just by thinking about the opposite ends of the spectrum, both of which are a part of paying attention well. So focusing on something very narrow is a really important part of paying attention well and learning things. But allowing your mind to wander and giving it space to rest is also a really important part. So I think both of those are part of the virtue of attentiveness. Mm. I think part of the trouble is that in the modern world, we often find ourselves doing neither of those. We're on neither end of the spectrum. We're just kind of in a weird in-between place where we're neither resting our attention nor focusing on something hard. Wow. We're just being distracted from thing to thing.
So what would you say to someone who says, oh, well, I'm paying attention to this YouTube video, or I'm paying attention to my social media feed? How would you distinguish between what they're doing and attentiveness?
I think there's a lot of really good psychological literature on why the state that you're in when you're watching YouTube videos is different from the optimal sort of attentional state, which is often called flow. So you'll see flow talked about in a lot of the
Progressive commercials, right?
Yeah, exactly. with John Hamm. FLOW is talked about a lot in the psychological circles as this sort of experience where you're just really, really invested in what you're doing. So think about if you have like a problem you really, really care about answering, and you're trying to figure out the answer, and you're really engaged, so engaged that time is seeming to pass really quickly and you're not thinking about other things. You're really focused on it and you're kind of at the edge of your abilities. You know, a lot of people will find that doing a really challenging physical activity, or playing soccer, I imagine, or baseball, I imagine you can really get into a flow state.
I've had that like writing a paper sometimes when the ideas are just flowing, sometimes you might say.
Yeah, and that's part of why it's called flow, I think. Yeah. But there's that sort of attentional state where a lot is demanded of you. You have to be really, really active and focused on whatever you're doing. But even if it's something that's meaningful to you, we get really tired of that pretty quickly. You can't be in a flow state your entire life. You have to rest your attention through things like sleep, but also through things like what one psychologist, Stephen Kaplan, calls attentionally restorative experiences, which are things like going on a walk through nature, things that give you a way to rest and recuperate your attention so that you don't have to be active, and give you space to kind of allow it to roam. So I think both of those sorts of experiences are really important, and neither of them is the sort of experience we're in when we're going through YouTube videos.
Isn't that just leisure?
Yeah.
Or at least very similar to leisure.
That makes sense. I think leisure would be a form of attentiveness in some sense. Yeah. Whatever that might be.
I've even heard leisure defined as attentiveness to reality before. So I think leisure and attentiveness are closely connected.
I like that idea, or just the way you articulate that, like being at the edge of your capacity, or edge of your
abilities. That's one of the key components for entering into flow.
But it's not necessarily like the edge of your energy.
Mm.
So like I think of, this might be connected, it might be a stretch, but I heard recently that apparently they told a sprinter to run 80% or 85%. And he did. And he ended up running his fastest. And it was this concept. And they were saying that this can translate to other areas of life where when we try to go 100%, we feel like we're like, or maybe the analogy here is like you're trying to focus really hard. You're like at your wit's end, at the edge of your abilities, right? Versus like in that flow state where you're on the edge of your ability, but it doesn't feel like it. It feels like you've got a little bit left. You're just in this state where you're just being productive, or you're just having these insights, or you're progressing along that, but you're not like at max energy, but you're at your most productive, I guess.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I wish I could repeat this experience, but I was in high, I haven't thought about this in a while. I was in high school and we were running, we'd have these 2.5 mile runs for soccer. And it was wet one day, and so we decided to run a 2.5 mile run on the road. And I remember, like, for the entire run, how good I felt.
Mm-hmm.
Just the entire time. Like, I just, mm-hmm. I felt like I was gliding. It was the easiest 2.5 mile run I ever did at the high school by far.
Yeah.
And I ran my fastest time by like 40 seconds, and I was like 20 seconds off the high school record.
Wow.
Or the high school soccer record.
Yeah.
And I just remember like, what just happened to me, and how can I repeat that?
Right.
You know, because I remember thinking this, how not tired I was. And that sounds like exactly what's happening there. Yeah. It's just like this state of, a little bit of effortlessness, you know? I don't know. Maybe that's flow. I'm not really sure.
But also just like a grace that was beyond your control that that's you right. happened to be in the state to do that at that moment.
That's right. Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. It's just,
and I bet you it feels like almost like, oh man, I felt so good. I could have tried harder and done even better, right?
Yeah, seriously.
But if you did, you probably wouldn't have.
Yeah. And also too, just how good does that sound to, to have something that you can be in that state in? You know, so I think a lot of people just desire to have something that they can be in a flow in, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. You know, there's so many people, I think, and I know I feel it too at times, like I just desire to have something in my life that I'm wanting to focus on so deeply.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just so absent for a lot of people. So
All right, what have we yet to hear on your attentiveness ideas?
Oh yeah, icons. We can talk about icons. So this is almost entirely stolen from Jonathan Pageau, who's one of my favorite thinkers on YouTube. He's a Canadian iconographer. But he gave a really great talk recently about how attentiveness shows up in traditional icons of the church. And so to give two examples, if you think of the classic Christ Pantocrator icon. Have you seen that one?
It's
the one where there's two sides
it?
Of Jesus. That might not be how you
thought it was. I can't even say it. Hang on. Christo Pentocrator?
Oh my, that goodness. Sounds even better. I like
hope
that
we
one.
Don't have any Greeks listening to this. Goodness gracious me.
All right. But there's a classic icon in which there's basically two sides of Jesus, one on which he's very stern, mm-hmm. and one on which he's like more tender and loving. And what Jonathan Pageau was saying is that those represent kind of the two sides of the dynamic of attentiveness. There's the really focused side, and you can even see on that side of the icon that the eye, the pupil of his eye, is fixed on you and focused very hard on you. But then on the other side, on the more mind-wandering side, his pupil is a little bit off and is kind of searching for souls to gather. Yeah. Right? And it's like the divine side and the human side. But then also in icons of the Last Judgment that will show up in the church's iconography, you'll often see on one side of Jesus at the final judgment, you'll see Mary, the Mother of God. And on the other side, you'll see John the Baptist. Mary, the Mother of God, who collected and gathered all things into our heart, like the mind wandering, the broad attention. And John the Baptist, who was very focused, very masculine, very like pushing away all of the things that were not relevant, saying, "You brood of vipers," to the Pharisees. Mm-hmm. So both of those sides representing those two sides of attention. So his argument was that these icons of the church actually encapsulate deep truths about what lies at the heart of human attentiveness and attention, because the gospel lies at the heart of all reality. Mm. But we can see it playing out in those icons as well.
Mm. Wow, that's a gorgeous way to think about icons. Yeah. He's an interesting person to listen to, by the way. Jonathan Pageau, he always has very interesting insights. Yeah.
For our listeners, he's like he's a contemporary of Jordan Peterson, and I think he's talked with Bishop Barron. I think he had Matt Fradheim on.
Yeah, Matt Fradheim on a couple of times. Yeah. He's a
Greek Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox.
I think so.
I think Greek. But yeah, also incredible. I think it's The Symbolic World is the name of his show.
But he is an iconographer, right? He paints icons. Yeah. So that's fascinating. You know, that's an interesting topic, because I constantly am wondering, and I think this is a huge element of the spiritual life, honestly, is not only being attentive to the Lord in our prayer life and in our daily lives, but also just being attentive to what He wants us to be attentive to. You know, is a huge thing that I wrestle with in my life of faith is in prayer. All right, Lord, what is it that you want me to focus my attention on? You know, if I'm sitting in the chapel, you know, that kind of a thing. Like when I'm out and about, you know, should I, you know, what I ought to do right now with my attention? You know, should I wander? Should I focus? Should I focus on this person that's walking by? Should I not? You know, just there's this this decision making that everyone has to do of what to do with their attention. And I think that's a constant back and forth between us and the Lord as to what to do there.
So how do we make that decision? Like, are there any helpful principles for deciding what to do with our attention?
It's a big question.
It is a very big question, yeah. One thing that I would say, and if you have thoughts, Dylan, one thing that I would say is, I love Thomas Merton's prayer, that I forget what it's called, but the main central aspect of the prayer is, you know, I am desiring to do your will, even if I don't, you're going to lead me down the right road, because you know that I'm desiring to do your will. So I think the point is, like, wherever I choose to focus my attention at any particular time or whatever, as long as I'm intending to do with my attention what the Lord desires, it's fine. He's going to lead you down the right path. So I think just operating in a sense of peace there.
Yeah, a sense of peace. I'm glad you said that at the end, because I think there seems to me, it's intangible. I don't know how to exactly describe it, but like, there seems to be a distinction between the things that I need to pay attention to and the things that are distractions, or the things that are, like, in prayer, but just in general, right? There are things that can occupy my mind that are very worldly, that are very anxiety-inducing. And these are things that I could even occupy my mind in prayer by. You know, I think of, it's very much a part of the Eastern tradition. You know, we've mentioned some parts of the Eastern tradition today and Jonathan Pageau, but there are certain things that are just beyond us. I mean, this is in Scripture and the Psalms as well. Like, there are certain truths that just aren't ours to fully grasp. And, you know, you find it throughout, especially the Eastern Fathers as well, of just this idea that, like, I might be wrestling with figuring out this one particular thing, and I'm just not meant to know, not meant to fully comprehend that. So I think that's one example of that in prayer, but even just like other more trivial kind of things throughout the day that you might want to kind of fixate on, that maybe it's not supposed to be the object of your attention.
So not only is insight a gift, but attentiveness itself is fundamentally a gift as well.
I think for some reason I want to make, this is just gut instinct, it might not work, but I want to make a connection between attentiveness and the virtue of faith. Mm. And particularly how faith is described in the catechism as both a gift, but like also an intellectual assent. So I think it'd be similar. It's like a gift, but it's also something we have to actively choose to have or choose to cultivate.
I think you're in good company with that assertion. One of my favorite essays by Simone Weil is called On the Right Use of School Studies with a View Towards the Love of God. And in that essay, when she's talking about attentiveness, she talks a lot about faith as well and makes the same connection. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot there. I like what you were saying about peace too. Mm-hmm. It seems to me like peace can be a really good sign of whether we are in the right attentional state or not. Because in my experience, you can find peace in a very active flow state or in a very passive, attentionally restorative experience. Mm. They might be different sorts of peace, but they're both peaceful.
Yeah. Well, and I would say all the fruits of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, gentleness, etc. Okay, so can we go back to that real quick? I just want to make sure I understand this. So this is the dichotomy, or these are kind of two things that we need to understand. So attention restorative, what's that called?
Attentionally restorative experiences.
Attentionally restorative experiences, aka catchy leisure.
And I think leisure is both flow and attentionally restorative experiences, though. I think
attentiveness. Wait, hang on. What was the second one? Was
flow.
Just flow.
Flow, okay, and so attentionally flow restorative and experiences.
Attentionally restorative experiences. These are two different things. Mm-hmm. Flow is where our attention is focused on something effectively. Mm-hmm. And attentionally restorative experiences is where it's a more passive.
I think they're connected with those, though. I think there's
connected to what?
Connected to the notions of activity and passivity. Okay. But it's tricky because in flow, you also need to sometimes step back and be passive. And when you are in an attentionally restorative experience, you might be active in some ways. So I think it's complicated, but I think that's close to right.
So how else would you describe the difference between the two then? I just want to make sure I have a good grasp on this.
One is taxing and the other is restorative.
So flow is taxing?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So again, it still sounds really similar to me to like work and leisure, the relationship between work and leisure.
Yeah, there might be a connection there. I'd have to think about that more. Then an analogy that I use to visualize these two extremes is breathing in and breathing out. So flow is sort of like breathing out, and an attentionally restorative experiences is more like breathing in. And I think one of the problems with the way we teach and train kids these days is we often act as if focus is the main and most important thing, which in my mind is like saying to a bunch of kids who are hyperventilating, breathe out, breathe out, breathe out, breathe out, breathe out, without recognizing that it's really about organically going back and forth between breathing in and breathing out and relearning that art. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, this is fascinating. I think the interplay between flow and attentionally restorative actions are really important. And one of the things that I read actually in Deep Work, the book that we were talking about earlier,
I was going to bring that up.
Okay, was I think one of the ideas that he brings forth is that you don't stop flow activities at the point where you start to feel tired and exhausted over them. The key is to stop them while you're still in the flow state. So that I think the intention is that so that you'll go back to them. I forget the details of why, but I think that's really an interesting thought as to how we should move back and forth between the states. You know, it's not, I'm not going to wait until I feel exhausted to go to the attentionally restorative.
Because you don't breathe out until you're completely out of oxygen and then breathe in again. You do it more quickly.
Yeah, that analogy fits. Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think maybe deep work can be a good thing to bring up and a good segue into, I think the last question I kind of want to talk about is, how then can we cultivate attentiveness? Because I think Deep Work, which is a book by Cal Newport, where he talks about just this art of productivity that we've kind of lost because we live in such a world that divides our attention so quickly, such a technology inundated world. I know one of his methods is like, he basically tries to cut out email. He thinks most email is unnecessary. Yeah. And you spend, the average workplace, you spend like hours a day on email, but you don't, it's like in spurts and you don't realize how much it is. And you can cut out most of it. Mm-hmm. But so things like that. But his big thing, deep work, is essentially like we need to work on things for a long chunk of time and not little spurts. Is that, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, that's definitely a lot of it. I mean, there's a lot to add to that. I would say that the theme of their thesis of the book is that deep work, which is essentially being able to focus intensely on something in order to produce something of value. That's a skill that a lot of people don't have that we increasingly need in our society. Yeah. So that's the thesis of the book. Okay. But I think you got it mostly right.
Great. So what else? What else cultivates attentiveness?
I think just searching for flow experiences and attentionally restorative experiences, because we spend a lot of our lives in in-between phases where we're not really in either of them. So finding small ways that we can find things that already get us into those states and building more of them in our lives. And then I also think a big part of it is cutting out things in your life that produce attentional states in you that you know are less than ideal. Mm-hmm. So especially if there's technologies that are dispensable in your life.
I mean, the biggest thing is social media or in the internet, basically anything that's instantaneous. Like I think of just the difference between reading a book with no technology in the room. And I know we talked about watching YouTube earlier and what's different about watching YouTube. Like I've noticed this before, like in watching a YouTube video, sometimes like maybe it's an 8-minute video and I'm not even through it before I'm thinking about the next video I'm going to watch or like what else I'm going to do after that. This is a totally different, it's clear I'm not in that state of flow versus reading a book, right? And not having that distraction. So that's the number one thing that kind of comes to my mind. It's just like, it's this technology flooded world that seems to hinder attentiveness for me.
Maybe a good question we can ask when thinking about those technologies or different practices in our life is this activity or this technology treating me the way a good teacher would treat me? Is it trying to cultivate virtues like attentiveness in me, or is it trying to grab my attention to keep me focused on whatever it wants me focused on?
That's a really interesting question. Yeah.
Also, like I think of that, like measuring a good teacher, to bring it full circle. It's like, is this teacher trying to grab my attention, or do they naturally win it over?
One of the things that I has impacted me in the Deep Work book that I think is relevant here is Cal Newport actually recommends scheduling every minute of your day. And
that sounds scary.
Yeah, and the intention behind it is not to enslave the person who schedules every minute of their day to the schedule. He actually suggests that you frequently adjust the schedule if needed, based on what happens in the day. The point is to spend one's time thoughtfully. When I schedule every minute of my day, I guarantee that every minute of my day is spent thoughtfully.
That's good.
And during that scheduled time, you know, if nothing more important comes up during that time, whatever, I know what I should be focusing my attention on. I think it's just a really powerful tool for someone who, and I know I've struggled recently with like just knowing like what is the best use of my time in this given moment. So it's been helpful.
Well, it sounds like And flexibility, I think, is key. But it sounds a lot like budgeting to me, right? Like, one of the things I've heard about budgeting is like, oh, it's, you know, it feels restrictive, right? But what budgeting does is it gives you permission to spend, right? If you set aside X amount of money for eating out in this 2-week span or in this month, then you've literally given yourself the ability to spend money to eat out, right? And you know that it's you have the money for it, right? And budgeting is that discipline. You can be flexible with it too. Like, I don't spend that much. Oh, I didn't need that much money for gas this month, so I can go spend this on a me fund or send it to savings or whatever, right? But it gives you that flexibility to adjust, but at the same time, you know where your money's going. Mm-hmm. So with what you're saying, scheduling your day, you know where your time's going. It's not gonna slip away from you because you've told it where it's going. You told yourself how you're gonna spend it.
Yeah.
With flexibility, I think that's necessary.
Yeah, and I think you can go too far to either extreme on the budgeting question or the attention question. Mm-hmm. You can be too capricious with your money and spend it too easily, or you can over budget your money so that there's not any flexibility mm-hmm. in it. And I think the same thing is true of planning our schedules. I think we can over plan our schedules or under plan them. I think we live in a world where we've gone way too far to the extreme of under planning where our attention is going to go. And so I think that's why these pre-commitment strategies, like the ones you're talking about, are really important to help bring us back to that happy medium.
Yeah. What else cultivates attentionness? Anything else we have? You said jiu-jitsu?
Part of the same thing. Yeah, I listed some of my favorite flow activities and intentionally restorative activities.
I don't know why I make this motion for jiu-jitsu.
You haven't seen jiu-jitsu yet. Yeah, apparently not.
I'm making like a, for our listeners, I think it's like a karate motion.
That's a very bad Karate Kid acting over there.
But I think that is one important thing to keep in mind when it comes to flow activities or intentionally restorative activities, is that our bodies really matter. And so when you're planning how you're going to pay attention, think about what your body is going to be doing, even if it means going for a walk while you're thinking about this important question, or, you know, getting your body engaged somehow.
Yeah, that's really good.
Well, I think too, I guess another thing I think of, I'm just thinking about like my own journey with like intellectual curiosity and how I discovered it. Like, I think sometimes it requires your attentiveness can mean that when you're listening to something, maybe you're reading a book, maybe you're praying, maybe you're sitting in class listening to a lecture. Well, your attentiveness can lead you down a rabbit trail, right? If there's something that the teacher says or the person or whatever that you read that like strikes your interest, allow yourself to go there. Maybe it's asking a question about it. Maybe it's contemplating it. Maybe it's writing the thought down, thinking about it later. Allow yourself to go there. I think sometimes what we do is we think, oh, that was cool, but I need to pay attention to what's being said next. So and like, true. I do this in prayer too. It's like, oh, that's a cool insight there in scripture. All right, next, you know. But we need to allow ourselves, when we have that moment of insight, to go there and not just to brush it aside, to keep paying attention.
And if you're a teacher, give space to your students to do the same, even within your classes. And if you see them staring out the window, pay enough attention to them so that you can know whether they're doing exactly that and give them space to wander.
Yeah.
Gosh, isn't that so hard as a teacher and as a coach too? Like, I've got this set curriculum that I've got to, there goes my cell phone, everybody. I've got a set, oh, look at this. Let me get it off real quick. There we go. Technology, everyone. PJ, I love that. But now I've lost my attention. Seriously, I've totally lost my train of thought.
So especially in coaching.
Especially in teaching and coaching, when I've totally lost it. It's gone. I've totally lost my train of thought.
Well, one thing I was going to ask you, maybe this will help jar it, but was particularly with attention, how do you see the relationship between attentiveness and coaching? Or what do you think there's a difference in how you cultivate attentiveness or the kind of attentiveness that's needed? You're still thinking about what you're trying to say.
Yeah. It's still gone.
But can you answer the question I asked then?
Yeah, maybe. I want to say, and this could be wrong, I want to say that in coaching, you know, especially in soccer, it might be different for different sports, but because they're just in motion so much, like the openness might be there more to focus their attention on a concept.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, the motion is important to activating the mind, it seems like.
So I think almost one thing that seems to me in coaching is helping them realize what they need to pay attention to. Because I know in baseball, I'm sure it's similar with soccer. Like, you might be just thinking about one thing, but there's something else going on the field that you need to pay attention to. And I think one of the things I see, you know, as coaches, one of the things we, you know, it can be kind of frustrating is like, they're just not picking up. They're not noticing something they need to be noticing. They're not, their attention just isn't even directed towards what it needs to be.
Yeah.
So it seems to me that's a key aspect is figuring out, okay, look, when you have the ball, right, in soccer, I'm going to stretch my thinking here into my non-native sport. When you have the ball, right, you need to be watching to see what's developing on your left, right? This guy might cut to be open, and you're not even paying attention to it, right? And you're missing your kind of opportunity there.
Totally true, yeah. I remember what I was going to say now. It's great. Finally back, yeah. Yeah, my attention's back. No, but I think what's really hard in teaching and coaching is letting the students and players stay with something, with an insight that they find is, you know, important or whatever. It's just this pressure to move on in the curriculum. You know, I've got the whatever it is in teaching the Common Core or whatever. I've got to get through this lesson this week, you know, and got to get through everything else in the 2 months, and we don't have time to stay with this topic. You know, oh well, I guess we'll move on. And same thing with coaching too. I've got this set plan that I want to do, you know, in a 4 or 6 week. Curriculum or whatever, and I just feel this pressure to move on rather than just let the students grasp something more deeply. So there's the pressure there. It's hard to battle that.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, I think we're about at our hour here. Any essential or non-essential closing thoughts? TJ just leaned into the mic like he's going to say something stupid, and then he backed off because he realized it was probably stupid.
Exactly right.
Nick just looks like he's going
to
do this.
Yeah, he wanted me to get off. PJ was about to say he wanted me to get off my phone and into the world. No, this has been a really fascinating conversation, and I think it merits a lot of attention for us and hopefully for our listeners. I just think this is a really, really, really important topic. One of the most important, I think, that we can contemplate in order to be full human beings according to the way that the Lord designed.
I think this certainly is a topic that's about being fully human and fully alive. And it touches on so many aspects of our life, our spiritual life, our intellectual life, and our physical life. Is that right? I don't know. I'm thinking about sports. Yeah. In our relationships as well, right? Paying attention. Like, PJ, I know you connected to, like, love as well, right? You definitely have to pay attention to those that you love in order to love them well. So, I think just so holistically relevant. All right. Well, thanks for joining us once again. You don't have anything intelligent, PJ? No, you exhausted all your intelligent things earlier.
No more insights from me.
All right.
His mind is now wandering.
That's good. Sometimes you have to know when to quit the flow state, right, while you're in it. I think we passed that. He's
restoring his attention over here.
Yeah. All right. Well, praise be Jesus Christ.
Now and forever.
Amen.